And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. The global carbon dioxide levels are 419.99 parts per million here in the beginning of July 2020. There are 2,735 days left until the year 2030. The clock keeps ticking. Today we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How you doing, Mariah?
I'm doing well. I'm super excited to be here.
Good, good. So, Mariah, as you well know, the economy is a big word, right? The economy is what makes everything go. And questions about how the economy relates to climate change are an important question and something people ought to think a little bit about. Turns out that recently there was a book has been published. And the name of the book is The Sustainability Scorecard, How to Implement and Profit from Unexpected Solutions. And it's a book that offers ways to think about how goods can be produced. In fact, better goods can be produced in a sustainable way going into the future. This is a critical thing for long-term climate issues. And of course, you say sustainable, you think of, oh my goodness, well, there's, how are we going to get the carbon out of Portland cement? How are we going to get the lithium for our batteries? All the sustainability stuff is very important, but there's a lot of choices we can make. And one of the things you can do is design your products to be recyclable and sustainable. Very important questions. Well, because we don't know that much about this topic, we are blessed to be joined by the author of co-author of that book to talk about what's going on. We're pleased to be joined by Urvashi Bhatnagar, who is a healthcare professional and has been working in environmental sustainability in the healthcare sector for a long time now. She has a doctorate in physical therapy from Boston University and an MBA from the Yale School of Management. So if anyone knows about the economy, it would be Urvashi. Urvashi, welcome to the Climate Minute. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I your book presents a lot of interesting perspective. I mean, so many barely keep up with. I gave a little description about what I think your book was trying to get at. Can you tell me what did I say wrong? What's right? Tell me the story about why you wrote a book called The Sustainability Scorecard.
Absolutely. Well, no, thank you for that perfect description, but I'm happy to elaborate. So I will say, I'll lead with why I wrote the book. I started my career in India, and a lot of my work was with underprivileged populations or populations that were vulnerable in some way. And from like the start of my career, it was apparent to me that one-time visits or ongoing treatment with your physician and your care team were clearly not the only determining factor to your overall wellness. There were a lot more factors that went into impacting your quality of life and overcoming whatever burden of disease was ongoing for you and your family. And so, of course, now in healthcare, we talk about this a lot. It's become a lot more of a mainstream conversation, which is social and environmental determiners of health. And health systems, healthcare leaders, data firms, everyone recognizes that we need to support patients by way of enabling their wellness by way of social and environmental determinants of health. We need to focus on health equity. But this is something that I had a front row seat to early in my career. So I always felt throughout my career that in physical therapy that I wasn't doing enough and I was always looking for a bigger impact. So that led me to data science and management consulting and those kind of things. And was also the impetus for collaboration with my co-author, Paul Anastas, who has a long career in green chemistry, very impactful work at the EPA and White House, and currently continues to not only publish leading research, but also invest in firms and also develop products and processes that are inherently sustainable. So it was a collaboration that I'm so grateful for and very lucky to encounter him at Yale. And that's how this book came to life.
And tell me, I think that the title of the book is A Scorecard for Sustainability. And my reading of it suggests that it is almost a technique that someone who is designing a product or running a company, a sort of a sanity check on, are you doing the right things to make sure that your product, and of course, I think this the book is aimed at the general question of sustainability, and the medical side of it, or the healthcare side, is one aspect that we want to talk about. But it's basically the theory is that there are common sense things you can be doing to check your process of developing products. Is that fair?
Absolutely. So I think in the present economy, I mean, there's been a lot of progress because ESG disclosures and reporting are becoming increasingly important, and it's become a step for compliance.
Raju, just let me, what ESG, for people who may not follow the acronyms, what does ESG mean?
So ESG means environmental and social governance. And so these are metrics that firms are required to collect data on so that they can accurately report their firm's progress along these measures. So it's not just your share price and your financial health. It's also how do your firm's economic activities impact environmental and social governance factors. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
These are voluntary reports, right? That companies are starting to do, sort of to say, look, we're making efforts, and these are what our efforts look like. Is that accurate?
Right. Yes, that is accurate. They were voluntary previously, and now reporting to the SEC is required, and therefore publicly traded firms are going to be audited along these factors. So there's a lot of work that firms are doing to ready themselves to be able to provide auditable metrics for ESG.
And these ESG things, these ESG metrics, which are basically like, how much carbon do you emit? You know, do you respect your workers? I mean, these things are all important, and the SEC would get involved because not doing well on these ESG metrics represents a risk to the success of the corporation, right? And that's the idea. It's not just we will do good nowadays. It's saying if you don't have these metrics in place, you're not going to make as much money as you might have. Fair enough?
Yes. And I would go so far as to say that, so considering this is now a compliance measure, there is a minimum standard. And we certainly want from an audit standpoint, and for clarity, I'm not an auditor, so I'm sure someone with a CPA would be, or a lawyer in this field would be able to provide a lot more detailed information. But I will say this, that risks related to climate and the economic shock of climate change has long been acknowledged. And these are the factors that were previously forming, you know, the risk assessments of all of these firms and made their way into sustainability reporting. Now that firms are being audited for it, there will be, I suppose, and remains to be seen, what these minimum standards are, how they fare against each other, those kind of things. This is a very important step. Economically, not just for firms, but also consumers who will be able to hold firms accountable. But I think what we need to do at this point is to look further and to say, you know, I'm glad that there's a minimum standard. However, in order to innovate and in order to actually embed sustainability into our corporate strategy, we're going to have to think about this a lot more strategically. We're going to have to embed this as a constraint within our design of our products and processes, and really evaluate how we're going to market and how we're creating our products.
It's interesting. So you the scorecard that's in the title of the book is essentially a step beyond the bare minimum of the ESG metrics. You say, okay, fine, ESG is fine, but if you know, here's the next thing you want to do. And when you say, Mariah may have a question, but when we say design of products, I mean, in my own career, one of the products we had was used a lot of SF6, which is sulfur hexafluoride, which is a horrific greenhouse gas, right? And trying to design that out was always a problem. So I think your book would have been a benefit to that organization. But Mariah, did you have a question?
I want to jump in. I mean, I think, first of all, I'd love to hear your description of who the best audience is for this book. And then the second part of that is, you know, you've got this sustainable scorecard, and one of the ways you say it's there's so many sustainability frameworks and different approaches, standards, and so on and so forth out there. And what's unique about this is that it's based on science. So I wanted to hear kind of a little bit more about that.
Absolutely. What we do in this book is that we say, let's look beyond compliance. And so when you're looking beyond compliance, you're thinking beyond risk. And you're thinking, okay, if I need to build resilience, and if I need to actually start competing with peers, and even firms that are not currently my peers, but they may disrupt my business practices in the future, then how do I ensure that I'm competitive in the market space? And I'm able to still penetrate the market. I'm able to capture my audience or consumers and deliver the best product possible. There's a myth that anything sustainable costs more, but ultimately functions poorly or suboptimally when as it's compared to, you know, other products in its class. So what we do is actually we look at how to innovate, and we propose a framework by which we say, look, there are four principles that we recommend that firms leverage when they are innovating their products and processes to be more sustainable. Focus on, for example, preventing waste, maximize efficiency and performance, use renewable inputs, and ensure safe degradation. So what we're saying is you are responsible for your product from the design stage where your budget is allocated. And all of your metrics are calculated. You're responsible for it from then to the point that it even leaves the consumer's hands and ends up either in a landfill or otherwise. We need you to think through in your entire strategy, will this product ultimately be upcycled? Will its component parts be mined and used elsewhere? And if it won't, will it safely degrade in a landfill so that it ultimately has no impact on the surrounding community? And, you know, history is littered with examples of contamination and things like that and exposure risks and whatnot. The way we go to market with our products and processes will really inform consumer health and population health in the future. And so we propose, by way of our scorecard, a way to leverage the 12 principles of green chemistry, which are scientific and peer-reviewed and widely acknowledged as being robust, a robust methodology for creation of products and processes. And we've turned them into management principles so that business leaders, innovators, scientists, researchers, and consumers can more holistically think about how these products and processes are created, but also think about what they're buying and research it more holistically to understand whether they're buying something that potentially has healthcare risks associated with it.
And those parameters are great because, you know, as you led with, the myth is that it costs money to do sustainability, but you've got these four categories: waste prevention, right? If you are preventing waste, you don't have to pay for that waste to get lost. That means you have an inefficiency that you've gotten rid of, and then you have the maximizing efficiency and performance. So of course, there again, you're going to be finding ways to save money in the long run. And then using renewable resources, that category may come with some expense in the short term, but in the long term, you can have some good recovery of your investment on that too. So I really like the setup of these four categories. And how it leads into that idea that, you know, being sustainable doesn't mean you just are going to lose a bunch of money, which is this big myth.
Yeah. And actually, one thing I'd love to kind of dive into a little bit more is the definition of performance. We just talked about the myth that, you know, anything sustainable ultimately is, you know, suboptimal in terms of the efficiency or efficacy, but you end up paying more for it just out of the goodness of your heart because you care about the planet. And what we say in the book is that we need to revisit the definition of performance. We need to expand the definition of performance to say that my product should be more efficient, should be superior in performance to others in its class, or just, you know, if you're really dealing with a leapfrog innovation, create a category of its own. So it needs to be very high performance, but it also needs to be socially responsible and be environmentally responsible. And there are certain industries where, you know, you have innovation that is actually fulfilling this today. And of course, more work needs to be done. There's a lot of knowledge gaps. For example, how are we going to solve the e-waste problem? A lot more research is required in this area. But that said, there's a lot that firms can do now to ultimately create products that are higher performing, but also are socially and environmentally responsible. And we get into a lot of use cases and examples in the book to provide that aspiration for firms that are looking to understand how they can do that, and for consumers to understand what they should be looking out for.
Excellent. I mean, I think that's great. The thing I wanted to put in to make sure that everyone, well, I guess what we're speaking at, you know, products in quotation marks, but I mean, that is an economy wide thing. The product is your car. It's the cream you put on your hair. It's, you know, there's so many different things that are a product. And what you're advocating for is that all of those products should be designed with these ideas using this checklist. So we say, you know, we produce products. Yeah, the United States economy produces products. What you're urging is that companies that are making, you know, a new toothbrush or something else, think about all of these issues as they design that product, and that is would produce a superior product. And, you know, I guess one of the questions that popped up for me, I thought you were going to go to say that we need to redefine the idea of performance as including the sustainability aspect, so that a product that is not, shall we say, biodegradable or not cradle to cradle, you know, where it's going to get reused, that is not a well-performing product. Is that
exactly.
Is that the kind of thing you're thinking about as well?
Absolutely, 100%. And so before we started recording this podcast, I know we discussed, for example, green hospitals, and what are some of the steps that hospitals can take. Now, that's a really interesting scenario because infection control is, you know, desired by everybody, by hospital staff, by patients to prevent cross-infection. I mean, the importance of infection control cannot be overstated. And so in a sort of difficult, quote unquote, scenario like that, how would we solve for sustainability? And actually, we get into an example of this in the book. We describe the leading work of a gentleman named Roger McFadden, who has developed a line of janitorial products called Sustainable Earth that were ultimately bought by Staples. And it's really interesting how those products were innovated by expanding the definition of performance. And so once the component part of these chemicals were considered in their overall go-to-market design, they realized, well, our current lineup just doesn't, it is not performing well, because it may be providing infection control, it may be providing cleanliness in a hospital, but we have, you know, really high sick days, we have a high degree of accidents with, you know, spills and things like that of these chemicals, and it's exposing the workers, it's exposing the patients, and ultimately this is not a high performing product. And so this product line was actually innovated along the 12 principles of green chemistry to be safer yet perform at higher than others in its class.
You're saying that, so these specific chemicals are more effective at preventing infections, killing the bugs, so to speak, right?
Exactly.
And at the same time are more sustainable.
And, exactly.
And this is something I, as I was looking at the at your book, I mean, is the principles of sustainable, the green chemistry, right? It seems to me that there must be a lot of value or improvement that can be made in the manufacture of the chemicals long before it gets put into the medical bottle.
Absolutely.
Right? And that you're making some chemical in a factory, and there must be a thousand ways to make that more sustainable, which then ripples through to your final product. Fair enough? Is that true?
I mean, you are really, really solving for this. Now, this is something we get into the book as well, where we say, you know, businesses today, they have tons of silos. Every department will function like its own unit. They may have some legacy collaborations between different departments and things like that. Product innovation even occurs through a certain methodology and may not involve every single department, but you're right there, Ted. This necessitates, if a firm is trying to truly create inherently sustainable products and processes, we will have to break down the silos between departments and create a closed loop system that impacts everything. And so if you asked me, Irby, what's your book about? I would say, well, this is actually an operations book on innovation and how to scale it. It's not only sustainability. It doesn't belong in a niche, you know, section of your library. This is a really holistic management book to think about how to run your firms in the future.
Interesting. Interesting. Go ahead, Mariah. Sorry.
Well, just to circle back, you know, this going back, but I want to sort of highlight this because I know it's something that's really close to your heart, you know, based on sort of your initial impetus into this world from New Delhi, where you were noticing health effects. You know, you were talking about Roger McFadden's sustainable earth products and mentioned about sick days and so on and so forth. These products are also better for the health of the people using them, right? That was one
exactly.
of the other big things. Better for the environment, but also, you know, you're using these toxic chemicals when you're cleaning, and it makes you sick personally. And so moving towards these products, it's also a health protection thing for the workers.
Exactly. It's health protection. It ultimately saves firms a lot of money and is better for business if your employees are healthy and don't have to take time off of work and their families are not impacted by illness. And it saves further on your expense management when you think about transportation and what's the optimal way to package these products and things like that. So there is a lot of innovation that this gets into outside of just the actual creation of these products.
And I'm sorry to take us sideways there, but I know that that's something close to your heart and I wanted to kind of highlight it because
yeah.
I know that's a big passion for you. But we, you know, we were talking about the operations and how to scale it. That's kind of the main point of your book. So that's one of the hardest challenges with the sustainability strategy is how do you keep it from being siloed?
Yeah.
So what do you recommend? How do you get these interdepartmental? Like, do you have someone who moves between departments helping think of ideas, or what would you suggest?
And if I could just, before you continue, when we say siloing in a manufacturing company, you're talking about the engineering group not talking to the manufacturing group, who's not talking to the marketing group, right? That's the silos within a company that we think of.
Right. And I mean, you can really go down the rabbit hole on that. Like your safer chemicals department not speaking to, your supply chain department, not speaking to your procurement department, not completely speaking to your source to pay. I mean, this touches the operations, touch every part of your finances. And so it really is about breaking down those silos. And we get into some firms that are doing a really good job of that right now and have a great vision for going forward in the future. What we talk about in the book essentially is to say, come up with a pilot, innovate in an area that's quote unquote safe, where you know that you can get some initial wins. And once that business case has been proven, you can then leverage the goodwill and the revenues from that to expand your pilot into other areas. And yes, you are starting from the path of least resistance, but at some point you will get to the point where you actually have to solve for some more difficult issues, but you will have the revenues from previous innovation to fuel future innovation. You'll have the buy-in of your employees. You'll have the visibility from your consumers who understand that you're trying to do the right thing. And so again, you're closing the loop on that.
This touches on a lot of stuff that I get a kick out of. But I mean, in my younger days, the industry I was in was very concerned about new product introduction, NPI. There was a whole process with gateways and milestones. You had to go through all this stuff, but none of it ever touched on sustainability. And as you said, there's lots of sort of metrics and guidance out there nowadays. But do you have in the book, you talk about processes that incorporate sustainability issues into new product development. And at the same time, there are other places that have been making, Cheerios for the last 500 years, right? How do they change their process that's well established? Right? Is there, what should people know about that kind of incorporation of sustainability into either new or existing processes, economic processes?
Just to make sure I understand correctly. So what you're saying is, how can large organizations with embedded capital and embedded processes, how can they innovate? Am I understanding correctly?
I'm saying on one side, there is that large,
yes,
stable. And then there are other places that may not necessarily be startups, but are introducing new products more or less from scratch. And yes, my own experience is more or less in the computer capital equipment industry, where you're building some big piece of equipment, right? And there's lots of decisions that have to go on in order to keep investing the money in the new product. And it would be, that is the place to incorporate the sustainability metric to say, have we asked these questions, right? Have we reduced, yeah, the waste of everything coming in from all around the world in order to build this thing, right? And so I just is posing those two sides of the question, exactly, about how to incorporate stuff.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. So when it comes to startups or small firms, they're more nimble. They can even change the DNA of who they are and pivot. And so there's a degree of agility there that works in their favor. And that's certainly a card that they should play in order to be more competitive and in order to reach their consumers with products that are better for you or disrupt existing products in their space. So that is there. And yes, that audience is, ripe for leveraging the sustainability scorecard, because there might be low-hanging fruit or leapfrog innovations that they can more immediately incorporate into their operations. And that's certainly an advantage. Something that we, larger ships are harder to turn. And so when you get into large firms, Fortune 500s, these kind of things, what we say and how we propose that innovation occur is that when sustainability becomes its own department, now you're creating another silo for sustainability. You know, sometimes it falls under the purview of your risk and cost accounting professionals. Now it's only a compliance measure for you. That's what you're telling the world and your peers who are watching what you're doing. And sometimes it becomes a marketing, a marketing platform, which is important. Commitments by CEOs and leaders to say, we have our eye on the future and we want to do better for you is important. But then that needs to be backed up by actual innovation and actual actions. And so in any one of these cases I've described, it's really common to see today, you've now created a silo. So what we recommend large firms do is actually put sustainability within your strategy and planning department. Just have it be within your strategy so that it is, you can almost think of it as one more line item that forms a part of your design constraint. For example, I need a car that takes me from point A to B, looks great, provides fuel efficiency, and is sustainable. That's a complicated use case. I probably could have come up with another example. There's a lot of research.
No, but I think your point is that having the thing built into all aspects. Because you're absolutely right. Once somebody gets a star on their forehead and they're in charge of sustainability, basically they've given an office in the other wing and everybody forgets about it, right? Because they're not integral to how the firm's operating. And so at the large firm, you want to put that sustainability into daily operation so that it just gets woven into the way that people think. And then you
exactly. Right, and then you don't lose those threads. When it's in strategy, it has the overview of your CEO and his or her peers. And so you have that top line messaging, the buy-in and the commitment that says a lot to everyone that's actually working at the firm. And so you have the top-down messaging, you have it being embedded within your strategy and planning. And then now operations, finance, everybody, that now you have the ground up actual action that will make its way up for innovating your actual processes. So whether it's finance, now we're going to be looking at the triple bottom line. If it's your operations, you're going to make sure that, you know, your suppliers are going to be providing, you know, better chemicals for as your inputs. So it affects, that's why we recommend for large firms that they not create a special department, that they include it in strategy and planning. And that's a function that is sufficiently important enough and high enough that it receives direct visibility from your CEO and also allows for that ground up action.
Before you, I know we're running short on time, but this is one thing I really want to make sure to, I don't know, bring out for our listeners. If you're within a business and you're thinking strategy, all this stuff, your book can certainly guide you in that direction. But one of the things I thought was really cool about your book was all of these examples of products out there that I was like, I want that now, right? You know, this idea of better products that comes to mind, like the Tesla Roadster, the new one, when it came out, people didn't want it because it was an electric vehicle. They wanted it because it could go from 0 to 60 in like 2.4 seconds. It was like the fastest car out there. And that's why people wanted it. And so, you know, this idea of making products that are better products and people want them, you know, they're the demand for them is there because it's better, not because it's good for the environment, but because it's better. And so could you just give us some of the examples you mentioned in your book, like the cement or, some of these different ideas that, I know you mentioned sustainable earth products already.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh my gosh. There are thousands and thousands of products, and I apologize for the ones that don't immediately come to mind while we're recording this. I will say overall, a great resource to look at is if you Google the Presidential Green Chemistry Awards. These are innovative products and processes that actually follow our methodology, that leverage the 12 principles of green chemistry to truly innovate what they're doing And there are a lot of leapfrog innovations there that you can find in grocery stores and in your pharmacy and in everyday products. So that's a great resource to check if you're looking for something like that. The ones that we talk about in the book that are that more immediately come to mind, for example, are the work of P2 Science. So they are a chemical manufacturer that is innovating the chemical inputs into your cosmetics, wellness industry, hair care. And that's really interesting because when you think about it, even if you go to EWG.com and the organization does a fantastic job, Environmental Working Group, every time I buy makeup or anything, actually, I go on there because I want to evaluate the risk of the product that I'm buying and whether it has any reproductive toxicity effects and things like that. And so the organization does a fantastic job of ranking the products, at least with the known risks. But what P2 Science does is that they actually use the 12 principles of green chemistry to create better products. And so they are as effective, if not better, than you know, the chemicals that are out there for your makeup and things like that. But they're also better for you. And so they have a collaboration with Living Proof. And there was recently a press release out of that. Living Proof is a subsidiary of Unilever. In hospitals, there are researchers at Yale and other organizations that are using green anesthetic gases to significantly reduce the side effects of anesthesia. Some fabulous work going on. Wow. In the anesthesia space. Then we talk about refurbished medical devices. And this is probably getting very much into the weeds, but at a high level, medical devices, if you look at sort of the balance sheet in a hospital, right, the number of medical devices or even the same device produced by different firms is enough to make anyone's eyes glaze over. There's thousands and thousands of products that are out there that are performing the same function. And the thing is that these are single use items. And so
when you say medical device, do you mean that the thing beside your bedside that's beeping, or do you mean the right. plastic needle that they inject you with? I mean, what's a medical device?
By medical devices, I would say they are, yes, the products next to your bed that are beeping, like your ultrasound machine and heart monitor and those kind of things, but also even pacemakers and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so there are great organizations. I'll call out Dan Volkolich for his amazing work in the space to actually advocate for greater use of refurbished medical devices because they go through the exact same procedure for checking and sanitation, but they have really low uptake because of the lack of awareness among medical providers. And the thing is that these products, when they're refurbished, they're naturally cheaper. They are more affordable to a vulnerable population or perhaps even an uninsured population, so they can actually afford them. It's a huge win for payers, wow. for providers, for patients. That's something to get into. Yep.
That's a remarkable list of fascinating things. So let me just say six things. One, I hope you can come back on and continue this conversation in the very near future because it's fascinating, lots and lots of stuff. If people wanted to read this, check out your book, read it, where would they go? Where can they find it online or stuff like that?
Absolutely. So if you can find more information about us at thegreeninnovationproject.com.
Greeninnovationproject.com.
Yes, the combination of green and innovation. The Greeninnovation Project. Also you can find us, you know, in stores, Barnes & Noble, online, at Barnes & Noble, or even indie books, Amazon, everywhere.
And repeat the name of the book so people can, in you and your co-author's name, just so that people one more time can hear it.
Certainly. It's the Sustainability Scorecard, How to Implement and Profit from Unexpected Solutions, by me, Urvashi Bhatnagar, and Paul Anastas, with a foreword from Mark Terpenning, the co-founder of Tesla.
Super, super, super. Well, what we will do is we will put up links at the MCAN blog. So we've mentioned a lot of them here recently. We'll put up a link to the book. You can find that by going that blog, by going to Mass Climate Action. You look across the top, you go to newsletter, newsletter and more, blog and podcast. You have to drill down a few things. And in fact, I need to get, I need to renew my password to get stuff up there, but that's a whole other thing. If you have questions about the show or suggestions of things we ought to talk about, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what we should be talking about. You may be listening to this on your smartphone using one of the modern podcast distribution apps. Please ask all of your friends to listen to us on their favorite modern podcast distribution app. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, search for Massachusetts Climate Action. We want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. We want to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. Because of that, we have to insist the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities. So, Mariah, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Urvashi, thank you so much. Fascinating book. Really, really enjoyed our conversation.
Pleasure was all mine. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool. Ha 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 ha.